Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 3rd of November. The author of Read Me is with us this hour, a century of classic American book advertisements. The book is a visual survey of book ads plucked from yellowing newspapers, journals, and magazines, large and small, from across the United States during the 20th century. Our author says, together, these random ads tell a story about America's literary culture over the past century or more. The ads show us works like On the Road, Sister Carrie, Catch-22, Invisible Man, Silent Spring, The Great Gatsby, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 1972, and many more. And it's interesting to look at what genres were most popular from decade to decade. Dwight Garner is book critic for the New York Times, a former senior editor of the New York Times Book Review, founding books editor of Salon.com, and he's working on a biography of one of my favorite people, James Agee. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Dwight, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I'm wondering how you decided to do a book on this, because you would think, how would it be possible to do a book on this? And it turns out that it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, isn't it? I tell you, it's over the years, while doing research for various articles and book reviews, I would, you know, go through old magazines and newspapers looking for articles for my own reading. And as I did this, I began to see along the margins and along the sides of these articles these beautiful book ads that just popped out like posters, like works of art. And I just started, you know, collecting them. I would Xerox them, or I would, you know, take them offline. I would, wherever I could take them, and I would file them away. And the more I looked at them, the more they spoke to me. They're just filled with so much information about how high culture was sold in this century, full of information about writers, about books, and how they were published. They're just fascinating small documents, and they're kind of beautiful, I think.
Yes, they are. Let's talk about endorsements from other authors. You know, when I read your book, I was thinking about what Justice William O. Douglas said about Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, the most important chronicle of this century for the human race, and it made me want to go get that book immediately.
Yeah, I mean, you look at these blurbs, and blurbs tell you an awful lot. I mean, for one thing, you know, there's a lot of history in them. I mean, who remembers that, you know, Jack Kerouac gave Ken Kesey a blurb for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or that Dorothy Parker praised John Updike's first novel? And it's funny, blurbs, they're often a little bit dull. They often use the same words over and over again, you know, compelling, gripping. But often, one of the funny things you find looking through this book is there's the fine art of what I call the backhanded blurb. Some blurbs seem like they're praising a book, but actually they may not be. I mean, Dorothy Parker said about John Updike's first novel, The Poor House Fair, she wrote, "It stays with you on and on." And I read that, and I think, well, you know, so does bad stew. You know, so who knows what she meant. Maybe she did mean it as praise.
Yeah. Did you find that there were certain types of books, be they books on etiquette or books on counterculture or books on spies or politics, that dominated each decade that you write about?
You know, not so much. I mean, the etiquette books come and go. I mean, we have them. They've always been terrific big sellers. My book has a number of ads for things like, you know, etiquette books and cookbooks and, you know, the biographies of sports heroes. But I focus quite a bit in this book on literary works, on novels, on fiction. And it interests me quite a lot about how American publishers went about trying to market these difficult works. I mean, it's fairly easy to sell a cookbook or a book on etiquette, because there's a constant market for that. But marketing, you know, the first book from Leo Tolstoy is a different kettle of fish.
Yeah. It's one of those books that you wouldn't even expect would be advertised, Tolstoy's books. Or Leon Trotsky, you have him here, too. How do you make an ad for those?
Well, I mean, you know, they're very canny. I mean, you know, at the time, Trotsky was a major figure in the world. So I think and he had such a distinctive face, with that terrific wolf-like goatee. I think they just, you know, if you look at the ad, it's this terrific eye-popping ad with Trotsky in the center of it, and I think people knew who he was and probably just picked right up on what they meant. It's much harder with something like a first novel. And one of the things that moves me about these ads is that many of them take you back to a time in a writer's life when he or she wasn't well-known at all.
Right.
Right now, we think of people like Toni Morrison and Cormac McCarthy as just huge figures in our literary world. Well, at one time, they were just young writers with their first book out, and these ads take you back to that moment when who knew if people were going to buy, you know, this writer's book? Were they going to disappear? Their books were jostling on the shelves with hundreds of other new books. And looking back, there's a kind of innocence to these ads now.
Right. That picture, I can't remember what the book was for, but the picture of Truman Capote that's in here,
yeah.
My gosh, he looks like he's 10.
It's one of the famous book ads ever. It ran in 1948, and it's just this incredible shot. It was for his book, Other Voices, Other Rooms. And there had never been an author photograph quite like this one of Truman Capote. He was laying on his side on a kind of couch and staring the reader directly in the eye with this very frank, direct, almost sexual gaze. Mm. And it really shocked people, and I think it helped sell his book.
Mm-hmm. What about the use of authors' pictures? It wasn't common, right?
It wasn't common until, you know, maybe the 40s and 50s. There just weren't that many photographs in the ads. There weren't as many in newspapers in general back then. It was a much harder process to get a photograph into a newspaper. So what you see throughout the, you know, 1910s, 20s, and 30s are largely drawings and type treatments. I mean, publishers did a lot with type, and they, you know, put you know, in large print across the top of a lot of ads, you know, the year's best novel. I mean, just, you know, shouting at the reader.
Right. How often would there be just the repeat of a title or the repeat of words? Sometimes it would just be a headline that would be over and over and over and over. I noticed that a couple times in the book.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many different ways. I mean, early on, it was often just the author's name and the title in bold print. And as time went on, you know, authors or publishers got very canny about marketing books. And one of the things they learned to do, one thing publishers love to do, is, you know, repackage and resell the works of writers who aren't with us any longer. So in 1927, a publisher, Doubleday, in fact, tried to sell the collected works of Joseph Conrad. And Conrad's a very serious writer and a complicated writer. And they did it by having a huge full-page ad of a young, you know, blonde woman sort of passing out in this demon's arms under the headline, Jungle Love, What Happened When a White Man and a Native Girl Met Far From Civilization.
Yes.
And it's just a funny way of marketing Joseph Conrad. And I wonder how it
right.
is. I don't know.
It is a pretty funny little ad, isn't it? Yeah, it captures your attention. The world's first paid print advertisement for any product was for a book, you write. 1647.
Yeah. 1647. It appeared April 1647. I'll read you the ad. It read, "A book applauded by the clergy of England called The Divine Right of Church Government, collected by sundry eminent ministers in the city of London." And, of course, the first three words of that are, "A book applauded by the clergy of England." Of course, today, if this book were marketed, it would just simply be applauded across the top, because we've learned how to do that now.
Oh, I'll run out and get that right away. That sounds all right. What about pairing? You write about this, books and coffee.
Oh, it turns out that books and coffee were a match from quite early on. I mean, they were sold together long before we had Barnes & Noble's and Starbucks. I mean, the second coffee shop to open in London shared a space with a bookseller named Daniel Pakeman. And so this is not a new combo.
Talk about the problems that some writers have concerning promotion, either self-promotion, and you can look at modern times, they're not wanting to do book tours or interviews. Yeah. There are, of course, we in this business know that, some people who don't want to do that, and others who realize and have realized for a long time, people like Mark Twain, that you need to get out and talk to people.
Yeah, I mean, writers like to say that they hate, you know, anything that smacks of, you know, grubby commerce, but in reality, most writers love having a book ad, and you know, frankly, very few writers get book ads. They are extremely ego-friendly documents. You know, writers love to see them in book review sections, and so I think writers have always loved to have them. The funny thing about book ads are is that, you know, no one really is sure how well they really work, and you know, that's one of the reasons why I think we don't see as many book ads as we used to. I think publishers are finding new ways of getting books into readers' hands in this format.
Mm-hmm. Who gets book ads?
What do you mean?
Who decide? What publishers? When publishers are deciding what they're going to advertise and what they're not going to advertise, who gets the ads?
Oh, you know, I mean, it seems more and more that only the biggest writers are getting them because they have, you know, written into their contracts, they, you know, it's stipulated that they will get book ads. You know, the Max Perkins, the famous editor of Scribner, used to say that, you know, if a car is really stuck, and he was comparing the stuck car to book ads. He wrote, if the car is really stuck, 10 men can't budge it. But if it's moving just a little bit, one man can push it on down the road.
Mm.
And then he said, by the same token, if a book is dead, all the advertising in the world won't help. But if it's got even a glimmer of life, you know, you can give it a push and get it started again. So you still see publishers advertising smaller books, thank goodness. Although I will say that a lot of this advertising is moving onto the web. We're seeing, you know, sort of trailers, film clips now for books. And in terms of book sales, blogs and other kinds of web conversation is more important than ever.
Hmm. Is that still the same? Maybe this just makes me feel like an old person, but I don't read a lot of those ads, or when they're on, I try to get rid of them. Whereas if I'm looking at a newspaper, but I'm a newspaper kind of person, I do look at the ads.
I know. Well, you and me both, Kathleen. I mean, I tend not to see ads online, and but I'm not sure if that's true of people, you know, in their 20s and 30s.
Hmm.
I don't know whether it makes more of an impact, but you know, I've always loved well-designed ads, and these book ads, you know, the combination of some excellent design and just having these terrific books make them, I think, really special things.
And what about reviewing books? Are there, I think you do write about this, that there might be some more likelihood if you have a really great ad for a book that a reviewer might be more likely to review the book?
Well, I don't think that's true. I think the kind of books that get large ads or often the kind of book, at least the kind of book you see in my book, you know, major writers like Faulkner who had these advertisements, they're the kind of writers that tend to get reviewed anyway. Sometimes I think publishers can up the buzz on a book and can get a book talked about by advertising. And sometimes that might snare a reviewer into reviewing a book when he or she might not have. But not all the time and not that often, I think.
How was, some of these people are so famous now that you can't even believe there were ads for them, but you just assume they were always famous. How was Ernest Hemingway sold?
You know, in many ways, because he had quite a few books, but his early ads were, you know, from Scribner published Hemingway, and they were extremely dignified, at least the first few, simple line drawings of Hemingway, and very simple and distinctive. And then as time went on, is almost to differentiate Hemingway from other writers. You would see early ads, for example, for F. Scott Fitzgerald, the author of The Great Gatsby, and they were, you know, showed him to be sort of a jazz-age city slicker, a drawing of him with his hair parted down the middle. And as if to differentiate himself from Fitzgerald, there were one great ad for Hemingway had him, you know, posed on cross-country skis looking like, you know, this hairy-chested He-Man, as if he just killed an elk. And I think it was just making a statement about Hemingway and his masculinity.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the person you're writing a book about right now, James Agee, who I think has really been under the radar for a number of years, perhaps a little bit more discovered now. Were there ever ads for Let Us Now Praise Famous Men or Death in the Family?
There was an ad for Death in the Family. It's not, alas, in this book. Of course, Death in the Family came out after James Agee died in 1955, and his book was published, Death in the Family, in 1957, and won the Pulitzer Prize that year. And there was one. There was an ad or two for Death in the Family. I have not turned up any ads for, I mean, Let Us Not Praise Famous Men, when it first appeared in 1941, was a very small book and sold only 600 copies.
Really?
And vanished almost immediately. The book really became quite well known when it was republished. And it was always a critical success, even in 1941. But it wasn't well known until it was republished in the 1960s. And it sort of caught on with a new generation.
It only, that amazes me that it only sold that number of books back in 1941.
Yeah, well, as you know, Kathleen, it's a very difficult book.
And, yes.
Let Us Not Praise Famous Men is you know, almost Joycean in its language, and it's extremely dense, extremely strange, very rewarding. I mean, like one of the best books, I think, one of the best nonfiction books ever written.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not an easy sell at
right.
all, and it just didn't pick up many readers. One of the reasons why is that it took A.G. a while to write the book. And, of course, as you know, the book is about tenant sharecroppers in Alabama during the Great Depression. And it took A.G. a long time to write this book, and by the time it did appear in 1941, you know, the World War was on the horizon, and people didn't care as much about tenant farmers and that sort of thing as they might have had a few years earlier.
Oh, interesting. It's the kind of book that I had to read out loud, and then, then it made more sense to me. But that took a while, too. It wasn't a short time. Tell us the story of, you know, some, this gets back to the issue of whether or not authors want people to say things about them. Tell us a story about Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was outraged, the Ralph Waldo Emerson and Walt Whitman story about Leaves of Grass.
Whitman was an exuberant human being and was exuberant in terms of promoting his own career. And after he had published the first edition of Leaves of Grass, I forget the year now, maybe in 1850, he published an edition and received a letter from Ralph Waldo Emerson praising Whitman's book. And Emerson wrote to Whitman, "I greet you at the beginning of a great career." And Whitman didn't just take the letter and you know put it in his pocket. He actually printed those words on the spine, on the outside of the next edition of Leaves of Grass. And Ralph Waldo Emerson was not happy about it.
Why the heck not? That was that was nice. You know, that was all right. Some of the people, let's look at some of the great writers of the mid-1800s, Edgar Allan Poe, Nathaniel Hawthorne, among them, far from overnight successes. Was their work noted in any way? How did their reputations grow?
Well, you're right. Both of those writers, or all three of those writers, were not overnight successes whatsoever, but they did manage to print, they didn't sell. None of their works sold well at first. Of course, they all became, you know, major writers as time went on. You know, Poe thought about founding a national magazine that would he could serialize his own work and that of his friends in. Nathaniel Hawthorne was upset and gave a famous quote that people weren't buying his books, and he complained about what he called this damned mob of scribbling women whose sentimental novels sold better than his own did. Hawthorne was funny, too. When The Scarlet Letter, of course, his most famous novel, was about to be published, he wrote to his publisher asking if they could print the title on the title page in red ink. He thought that it might not be in good taste, but it would be piquant, and people might like it.
Mark Twain, let's spend more time on him. Among the first writers, you say, who undertook something like the modern book tour. What did he do?
Well, he traveled around. I mean, you know, he really went from city to city, something many writers do now, and read out loud. And book buyers, you know, many book buyers want to know something about a writer and his or her personality before they buy a book. And Twain knew that, and he knew that he had it. I mean, he was a terrific public speaker, a great wit, and he could sell his books better than anyone else could. And so he actually, you know, went on the road, and which was something people simply didn't do back then.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll do that in just one moment. Our guest is Dwight Garner. His book is Read Me, A Century of Classic American Book Advertisements. And we should say that at the top of the book, it says, just published. And he is a book reviewer himself. It's a fascinating look at books from the past century. He breaks it down by decades and a lot of stories about books that have become classics. Dwight is a book critic for the New York Times, former senior editor of the New York Times Book Review, founding books editor of Salon.com, and is at work now on a biography of James Agee. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you're wanting to use an email, then that's fine. That's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Do you look at book ads? Do you like book ads that get you excited about the book in some way? Is it the picture that makes you excited? Do you like to read all those blurbs? Do you read all those blurbs of people who will give praise to a book that are on the back, usually, of the book, or sometimes in the first couple pages? Does that capture your fancy? If somebody you greatly admire gave a terrific review of a book and it was put in a print ad somewhere, would that make you go and get a book? And are we in an age as this is a generational thing is interesting, too. If you're a younger person, do you find that you read the ads and book ads on the internet would be something that would influence you much more than looking at a book ad in print? Do you pay attention to them? is the question. So we would love to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Read Me, A Century of Classic American Book Advertisements is what we're talking about this hour, and our guest is Dwight Garner, book critic for the New York Times. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and while the phone calls are coming in, we'll talk with Dwight for just a few more minutes and then start taking all of your phone calls. You know, one of the fun things about the book, too, is looking at what became of some of these people. There's an ad on page 244 from 1986. Only one man has the skills, the tenacity, and the high-level context to solve the Flight 007 mystery. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh.
Yep.
You know, and there's a picture of him as a very young man.
That is one of the great joys of seeing some of these people who we now are quite famous and we know their faces quite well, but seeing them, you know, 20, 30 years ago and they're just starting out and they just don't have quite the confidence, at least the confident look that they have today.
Yeah, it's fun. Let's go to phone calls for you. David from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, David.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, how are you?
Good. I happened to be tuning into the station and I just found it fascinating, the discussion. I've been really into digging through old print material and to find this stuff. I mean, book ads, but, I mean, for me, more like just old print ads in general and kind of the aesthetics that were applied to stuff over the past century. And I just feel like a lot of that stuff has been lost with the Internet because it's cool to dig for stuff online, but you're really not having the first-hand touch contact with something that's printed, I guess.
Do you read the ads on the Internet?
I'll read them. I mean, are you talking about ads like current ads or ads from the past that have been archived?
No, book ads, current book ads.
Yeah, not necessarily. Sometimes, I guess I'm more into them for the aesthetics. And that's kind of what the craft taken into each one of these things is sometimes so meticulous.
Mm-hmm. Dwight?
Yeah, I agree. You look back, and there have been some nice books published over the years of classic advertising in general, commercial advertising for things like, you know, cars and soap and beer. The book I've done, I think, is a bit more unusual. No one's ever collected sort of book cultural ads like this before. But I think he's entirely right. And, you know, I think if a book like this were to be done in 20 years from now, you'd probably have to do it on DVD. I think, you know, the stuff is all moving online,
mm-hmm.
which is a little sad. I mean, you know, who's to say this stuff won't be beautiful? But I still sort of love the old print material too.
Well, how do these ads get created? Are there departments in publishing houses, or do they outsource them to advertising agencies?
Both. Publishing houses do some of them themselves, and there are some small houses, advertising houses that specialize in doing book ads. And I mentioned some of them in my introduction. So it's a combination of both.
Thank you, David, so much for your call. Pat from Phillips. Hi, Pat.
Hi, good morning. I have a couple questions here. I'm a novice. I have a book coming out soon, and my interest on that is more for ego satisfaction than money. But I have two in the mill for the future. So my two questions are, how do I get an ad on Internet? And second, probably more important for the next two books, how do I possibly find an agent, which it seems to me would be pretty necessary, because there are a million advertised, and I can't distinguish one from another with any intelligence. So can you comment on these two things, please?
Yeah, I mean, finding an agent is never an easy process. I mean, it's gotten harder and harder. Agents I don't know a lot of them, but I know a few of them, get so many submissions per day, and they try to look at the stuff that comes in. They have young, dedicated readers who do read very often the manuscripts that come in, and I think you have to look around and find a few and send these agents your material. In terms of getting a book ad online, well, it depends where you want that ad to be. I mean, the Internet is not a monolithic thing. It's all kinds of blogs and magazines, and you need to decide where you want your ad to be. And it's a process. You have to have someone design the ad. It needs to look good. You need to contact the magazine or the blog where you'd like it to appear and find out what their rates are. I suspect the rates for online ads are not that incredibly high.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's absolutely imperative to find somebody to market what you've done these days?
You know, I sort of do. I think a book can catch on for a lot of different reasons in a lot of different ways. But I think if you publish a book, you probably need to hire someone to help you publicize it. Some people, Mark Twain, knew how to do it himself, but most writers simply aren't good salesmen of their own work. And it's good to have someone in your corner. There are plenty of, every publisher has a publicity department, but there are plenty freelance publicists out there who can help a struggling writer, get some kind of attention for the book to make sure it arrives in some of the right places where it needs to be mm-hmm. in order to get seen.
Let's go next to Todd from Madison. Hi, Todd.
Oh.
Hi.
Interesting show. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
When I go, I guess I look at books differently because what books are to me, I'll have something will trip my fancy, like a historic event or something, current event or something, and then I'll go to the bookstore and sort of look for the book that I have an interest in at the time. And so definitely what I look at is on the back of the book, when the blurb that other authors that I've read. So definitely the back of the book is what gets me to pick up a book, and the note on the inside cover. Other than that, they're just ads, really, to me.
Huh.
No, I hear you, although I will say in response to that a lot of times the same material you see on the back of a book and on its inside front flap, it's often the same material that the publisher will put into an ad. I mean, the front flap is always, a lively description of the contents of the book. And the back cover of a book tends to be, the terrific blurbs that an author's gathered from his friends and from other people he sent his book to for advance comment. So ads and the jackets of books aren't entirely dissimilar. I mean, a book jacket really is the best ad a book can have.
Yeah, but the thing about going to the bookstore then, you read the jackets, you read the blurbs, and then you just open to a random page and spend 20 minutes. And you can tell pretty quick if that's
yeah,
right author.
Yeah, nothing better than being able to pick up the book. I agree with that. Yeah,
that's the test.
Definitely.
Do all those people who write those blurbs actually, is it a requirement to read the book, Dwight?
Who knows? I doubt it in every case. I mean, in some of the blurbs, you can almost tell the person hasn't read it because the blurb they've given is so generic.
Right.
A terrific read. And, maybe they read it.
A terrific read. There's it right.
I don't know. In every case, I doubt it.
Yeah. Thanks, Todd, for your call. We have lines open for you if you'd like to join our conversation. 800-486-8655 is the number. Mike from Whitefish Bay. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
Just to inject a note of humor, there was a great cartoon in the New Yorker a few years ago, and it depicts this outraged customer shouting at a clerk and saying, "What? No espresso bar? And you call this a bookstore?"
That's good.
Yep.
How do you select your books, Mike, that you're going to read? Well, Mike is gone. How about you? How do you decide what you're going to read, Dwight?
Boy, I get a lot of books sent to my house. I mean, I'm one of the New York Times' three full-time book critics.
You must get hundreds.
I really do. I get between 5 and 10 books a day to the house. And, you learn. I mean, I've been in the business. I worked for a long time for the New York Times Book Review. And, you look at them all. You try to poke around. At least once or twice a week, I'll sit down with, 10 to 15 books and try to read 20 or 30 pages, and see what I think before I commit to reviewing a book. But it's hard. I mean, there are so many books that just don't, there are too many books to review them all, and it's heartbreaking often the choices you have to make in terms of what you do review.
What about those inside covers? Who writes those, and do you find that a lot of people read those?
What do you mean by inside covers?
The covers where the jacket thing, what do you call it?
Oh, who writes the jacket cover?
Yeah.
Normally that's that's the job of the publisher to write those, but normally, the writer has a strong interest in what appears there. So often the writer will write it, himself or herself, or will tweak what the publisher has done, because it's a really important bit of advertising for the book.
I found myself, and I'm not sure why I do this, sometimes to look for new books and sometimes just to get a feel for what's selling, but I always go to the New York Times bestseller list every Sunday when I'm reading the paper, and I'm absolutely flabbergasted at times to see what's on the bestseller list.
Oh, you and me both.
Are you too?
Oh, of course. I mean, you can't believe it. It's always the political polemics and, books about dogs and dead presidents. And
right.
It's been the same forever, actually. The kind of stuff that makes the bestseller list hasn't changed that much. I think there's a lot more right-wing and left-wing political books these days.
Yes.
It's quickly make it to the top. And
yeah.
perhaps more of those than there once was. It's funny, I've got an advertisement in this book for the book, Goldwater's book, Conscience of a Conservative.
Right.
And that was really one of the first major right-wing bestsellers in this country. There were a few before that, William F. Buckley's God and Man at Yale. But, you know, publishing in general, I mean, you know, you hate to overly generalize, but in general, the New York City publishing world is a vaguely left-leaning one, I would say. And ads or books like Goldwater's book that sold just hundreds of thousands of copies really woke people up and made them realize there's another half of the country out there they need to, you know, sell books to.
Hmm. Do people use bestsellers to sell their books to make them even more popular? I'm on the bestseller list.
Well, of course. I mean, anytime a book, you know, you have a better chance of getting a book ad if your book does make the bestseller list. I mean, publishers will pick up on that and run with it. And many of these ads you'll see, you know, at the very top, the New York Times bestseller or the, you know, L.A. Times bestseller. Once a book gets any kind of wind behind it, an ad can really push it along even more.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Virginia from Beloit. Hi, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm enjoying Dwight's conversation. Thank you. I wanted to ask this question. If it isn't the ads that attract your attention of all the hundreds of books that you get, what is it that causes you to want to review a book?
That's a great question, and it's such a subjective process. I mean, sometimes it's the topic. Mm-hmm. I review, you know, I am currently the nonfiction critic for the New York Times, so I review nonfiction books and nonfiction books only. And often, one of the things about reviewing fiction versus nonfiction, if you read a bad novel, it's really dismal because it's only a bad novel. Often, with a nonfiction book that isn't so great, the subject can be so fascinating, and it can still be a fairly interesting book. But, you know, the books come in, often they're books by writers I've read before, and I know that their work is terrific and I respect it, and so I'll want to read that. Sometimes it's simply the topic that catches my eye. There was a new book out this year about the Bataan Death March. You know,
yes, we did an interview. We had one of the guys on.
Yeah, just a
it was
subject
a great...
that, you know, we've all heard so much about it over
right.
time, but, frankly, I had forgotten most of the details about mm-hmm. what the Bataan Death March actually was and what actually happened, and it was just a riveting book, and it was a subject that I just felt like I wanted to know more about. And often walking around a bookstore, you'll see a book and you'll say to yourself, my God, that's just something I want to know about. And that's often how I'll pick a nonfiction book.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that hard, though, Dwight, because there are so many of them?
Oh, it's heartbreaking. I mean, I just,
yes.
there are piles and piles of new books that come out every day. And I feel for writers these days because there are fewer book sections in America than there once was. These sections have gotten smaller. There are fewer ads. And as we know, print journalism is hurting in general, and there are fewer and fewer review outlets. There are fewer book reviews. Reynolds Price wrote that when his first novel came out, I think in the 1950s or 60s, his book got 90 separate reviews from different places across the country. He wrote that now one of his books, he'll be lucky if he gets 20.
Really?
And that's Reynolds Price. Reynolds Price gets far more reviews than your average young first novelist would get.
Is he still writing? He hasn't been... noted for, is he still alive? He
yes,
is.
Yes, he is. Reynolds Price is alive. He had a terrific memoir out this year, actually.
Really?
Called Ardent Spirits, and about his time in Oxford as a young man.
Oh, Ardent Spirits.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read him for years.
Yeah, he's a very nice writer, and
mm-hmm.
it's a lovely memoir.
Oh, good. Thank you. That's where I'll be going to get that one. Thanks, Virginia, for your call. Mary is next from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hello. I wish this was an all-day program. I so would love to ask your speaker what he thinks about the direction women's fiction has taken. Many people that went through the women's movement are bitterly disappointed in part. It's not as if women are discussing lofty topics now. The market has been simply taken over by the vampire genre. Women seem to be drowning in romance. Maybe they think that's the most powerful arena that's left for them at this point, now that people are somewhat disappointed in the way their brilliant careers are going. I'd love to know what he thinks about the rise, and I realize this has periodically happened throughout the history of book writing, but we seem to be simply swamped in the sensational novel, the airport novel. And I notice now that the New York Times, no offense intended, has been reviewing popular fiction for some time, which was somewhat disappointing. And more they're reviewing it as if it was really important. I'm sure the speaker can see where I'm going with this, but I'd love to know what he thinks about this. Obviously, even the Greeks had bawdy plays, and perhaps this is a phase. Can he tell me his thoughts on this matter?
Well, of course, potboilers, mysteries, thrillers, romance novels. I mean, these genres, science fiction, have always been with us, and some of the books in these genres are really first rate, and actually, I think, deserve to be reviewed. You know, others are just hack work and don't really deserve a book review. But I'm not sure that, you know, the bestseller list has always been packed, you know, with commercial books. I mean, I think there was a time in the 40s and 50s when there was perhaps a bit more literary fiction and serious nonfiction on a list. But I don't think, you know, a great deal more. I'm not sure there's more dross being published today. As a matter of fact, you know, I think the book world in its way is really thriving. I mean, literary readership, I believe the last NEA survey I read was up quite a good deal. I think the people who want to find the good books are finding the good books. And, you know, I don't knock what anyone chooses to read. I mean, there's plenty of times all of us would like to read, you know, a simple, fun, propulsive book for pleasure. And I would never knock that. I mean, and a good deal of literary fiction has those qualities as well. But I'm not sure it's true that you know, the literary world is being dumbed down and that people are reading fewer serious literary books than before.
Thank you so much, Mary, for your call. Elizabeth from Shorewood, hi.
Good morning. I especially love the ads in the New York Review of Books, and I often find them distracting me from the reviews and the articles themselves. I love to give books as gifts, and these ads particularly are an inspiration for these random gifts.
And what kind of ads do you like? Do you like the so-and-so give this book high acclaim? Do you like the...
Well, you know how the publisher will often have a group of books that are somehow related.
Yes.
Somehow, you know, you have to dig a little bit to understand the relation. So I enjoy those. It's mostly, I like the publisher's ones, and there may be something, a blurb from someone else. And as far as the blurbs in the front of the book, Kathleen, I thought it was mandatory. I didn't know you could get to page one without reading a blurb. And thank you so much. This is very interesting.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you. You know, I think readers love book ads in much the same way they love the trailers when they go to see a movie. Because on some basic level, they're simply information. They're news about what's coming out and books they might like to buy, in the same way that film trailers are, you know, a bit of information about forthcoming movies.
I'm trying to remember which was the ad, and maybe there are several of them in the book, where three authors were packaged. They all have books coming out. And is that unusual to package a couple in the same ad?
No, it's very common. I mean, you know, book advertisements are expensive for publishers to take out, so often they will take out an ad that features, there's one here I'm looking at from Simon & Schuster in 1962 for Doris Lessing, Joseph Heller, and Niccolo Tucci.
That's what I was thinking.
You know, actually, those ads are extremely common. I have fewer of them in this book than I might have ordinarily because those ads tend to be quite large and the information is packed in quite small and they're not as visually interesting quite often. So in my book, I've focused, not all of the time, but very often on ads that were devoted simply to one book because they're a bit easier to read and a bit more visual pop to them.
Right. Thanks, Elizabeth, for your call. Let's pause for a moment. We'll return and take more of your calls and invite more of you to call. Dwight Garner is our guest. His book, just published today, as a matter of fact, I believe that's true, today, Read Me by Dwight Garner, A Century of Classic American Book Advertisements. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Scott from La Crosse. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Another wonderful program. You are so good.
Thanks, Scott.
The reason what prompted me to call, well, I was just listening and enjoying the show, but then what prompted me to call was when Dwight said that he was the nonfiction reviewer, because I tend to read pretty much exclusively nonfiction. And for those of us who do that, there's always this kind of double dilemma, which is, A, is it a topic we like, and B, is it a kind of writing style that we like to read or can, you know, just get into? And I wonder how he feels about one of these where you get a topic and you go, oh, that'll be great, And then you start reading the book and you go, uh-oh, this ruined that. And having said that, Dwight, then I should tell you, your book topic sounds like something I'll probably be looking into.
Oh,
I hope I like your style.
Well, it's mostly pictures.
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
Oh, I said, well, my new book is mostly images, but there's some of my writing in it as well.
Cool. Okay, yeah, but how do you feel about that? And there's sort of an ancillary item issue with that, which is if somebody writes a book that is on a topic that, as I say, I like, but does that have a chilling effect on other writers? Because, you know, somebody just wrote about this, and somebody else was thinking about writing about it, they're probably not going to sit down and do that topic again, unless, I mean, obviously, if it's, you know, something like 9/11 or something like that. But, I mean, you know, like the Edmund Fitzgerald, say, or something like that, that they're going to back off doing that. So do you just have that same sense of crushing disappointment?
I do. I do. A bad book on a topic can really kill the topic for about 20 years.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, because actually, I was just in Texas last week, you know, at the Texas Book Festival, and was talking to a writer I've known for a long time who told me he's always been fascinated with the wrestler Gorgeous George. And he was debating writing a book about Gorgeous George, and this fellow's a very good writer. And then he said, well, this other book about Gorgeous George came out last year, and he didn't think it was very good, and he felt like the topic was now ruined for him. He had to wait at least 15 years before he could, you know, come around again. So, yeah, a bad book on a topic can keep other writers away for a long time.
And by the way, speaking of Gorgeous George, just do you know that was really who Muhammad Ali patterned himself after?
You know, I think I heard that.
Isn't that cool?
I even read that Bob Dylan, you know, loved Gorgeous George and then met him early on in his career.
Well, thanks so much.
Thanks. Right. Tell us about the Bob Dylan book and the way that was advertised, the book.
Oh, Tarantula?
Yeah.
Bob Dylan's unreadable novel? I mean, you can try to read Bob Dylan's Tarantula. You'll have to read about a page a day. It's pretty tough going. Well, of course, if you have Bob Dylan, what are you going to do? This was Bob Dylan at the height of his career, you know, with the shades and the very big hair, and they just really just, you know, it was like a album cover, this ad for Dylan's book. Actually, I'm flipping through and can't find it at the moment, but it's just a really eye catching, popping ad of Bob Dylan, and of course it, you know, sold books for him. I think that book did quite well, even though it's one of the more difficult books you'll ever try to read.
Did it really?
Huh. My recollection is that Bob Dylan's Tarantula sold fairly well because he was a major cultural figure, and people just wanted to know, you know, what the book was about.
Right. All he had to do was beat Bob Dylan.
Exactly.
That was it. Thanks, Scott. Let's go to Kathy from Stoughton. Hello, Kathy.
Hi there, Kathleen. Hi there, Dwight. I guess that my question is kind of in relation to, again, I guess the changeover from print journalism, so to say, to more online things. And basically my question is, what do you think the effect of like online book club communities such as Goodreads and some of those kinds of websites are having and impacting the book industry? I guess you can speak to nonfiction, but even fiction as well.
Oh, I think they're a tremendous influence. I've never done Goodreads myself, and I don't know a lot about it. But I know that offline book clubs are now taken very seriously indeed by publishers. As you know, many books come out, and in the rear of them, you'll find, you know, questions. I mean, sort of ready-made
mm-hmm.
questions for book groups in the back. online books groups have the potential to attract even more readers. I've never used one. I can imagine that the best of them are quite good indeed. And I imagine they sell quite a few books. I know that the offline ones certainly do.
Hmm.
So I guess in my experience, what I have noticed as a participant myself is that a lot of that is maybe like I'm picking up books maybe from authors that I've never heard of or maybe some up-and-coming authors that I haven't heard of because of other recommendations from other readers that like similar things that I do. So I guess as far as that, it's almost kind of, I can understand where you're coming from, where you got to separate the really good stuff from the junk. And I've seen some of that online, but on that same token, there's been some wonderful authors that I have picked up that wouldn't otherwise I just would never have touched that.
Exactly. I think, you know, more and more people who spend a lot of time on the web, I think there are some very good sites people can go to and get some reliable information about books. A lot of websites, of course, you know, who knows who's writing them and whose opinion it is. But I think some of these book clubs are doing a very good job of getting information out to people.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye. Jack from Brookfield. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Jack.
Back 100 years ago, well, back in the 1940s, I used to win the reading exercises in my grade school classes, at least until Lorna Ives got there and beat me.
What did they consist of? What were the contests like?
Well, we had regular reading things in the class where the class would be silent and you'd have this reading assignment. I don't remember what any of the topics were, but it would take you 15, 20 minutes. Some of the kids wouldn't finish, and then you'd discuss the subject material.
Mm-hmm.
I figured you had that too. But, I don't know why I'm alone in that. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is, as fast as I was and as good as my comprehension was, I haven't read a book in so long I'm ashamed to tell you, even though I love them and libraries are my favorite place. How many pages an hour do people who read a lot of books read, like you two guys?
Hmm.
It's a good question. You know, it depends on a lot of things because all books aren't the same size. I mean, or don't have the same... There are different typefaces. The margins are different in many books. There's a lot of things that go into how many pages you read an hour. I find that I read between 40 and 60 pages an hour, depending on the kind of book and how small the type is and how wide the margin is. I don't know how typical that is. I know that I read moderately quickly. I always wish I read more quickly. I think everyone does. I've always wondered what a speed reading class would do for me. Probably lower my IQ, but I you know, we all do our best.
So you've never taken a speed reading class. Didn't you have to take one in high school?
No. Is that a common thing?
I don't know. I guess we had to, but I'm probably a bit older than you.
What does one learn in a speed reading class?
I didn't like it very much, and the reason why is because I remember that was the class I was in when John Kennedy was assassinated, and I'll always remember that being in the speed reading class. I think we used rulers and tried to move down the page as quickly as we could and not get every word. So you can't use it for a lot of reading that you want to savor, it seems to me.
And, of course, the best books you want to read as slowly as possible.
Right. Oh, I know, the ones that you hate to see end. The hate. You know, I find that, I've never been asked this question before, but there are some books, and maybe it's just the ease of reading it or the simplicity of language, but there are some books that are fairly good that you can read pretty quickly. Have you found that to be true that are surprising to me? Sometimes I'll read the whole book for an interview and say, wow, I can't believe I read that whole book. You can't read every book, of course, but some of them you have to really labor over.
No, exactly. I mean, you know, I read books for a living, and it's funny. You finally come to realize that the average book, people say, how can you read so many books? Well, the average book, I think, I would say it takes roughly 8 hours to read, and that's a very loose, you know, number, but I think about 8 hours, and big history books might take twice that, or a short novel might take you only 3 hours.
Right.
But, you know, when you think about it that way, a book doesn't seem quite so daunting. People, I think, you know, will see a book and think, well, you know, there's a month of my life, and maybe they're reading 10 minutes before they go to bed, but you can read a book fairly quickly if you can carve out just, you know, an hour or two a day for it.
Sure. Jack, why don't you read anymore?
Well, I just can't put in the time, and I'm discouraged at how long it takes me. It takes me weeks and months to read a book.
Mm-hmm.
The last book I read was the pseudonymous economist who wrote the book that was so popular in the 60s. I read it in the 70s. That's the last full book I read. I, too, read only nonfiction, more or less, because I need to know something about a subject, and I haven't got time to squeeze in any fiction.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Jack, you got to start reading again. I don't want to lecture you, except so what?
Well,
it takes you two months.
I'm too old. I'm older than you are.
That's okay.
But I have my schooling a few blocks north of where you live. So it was a very good schooling. It was rated by, I guess, Scholastic Magazine as the best in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had a lot of good opportunities, but in recent years when I've gotten busy with work and jobs and things, there just wasn't time to read. And, and now that I'm an old codger, there isn't time to do anything. I'm still thinking about making breakfast.
Well, I see breakfast with a cup of coffee and at least a newspaper, right? Or some work of nonfiction that you can browse through that has some pictures in it, right? There are a lot of presidential books like that.
Or Read Me by Dwight Garner.
Hey, there's a good idea. Just published today, right?
Indeed.
It is just published today, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, that's great. All right, Jack, thanks very much for your call. Do you have books, too, that you just... I feel guilty about this because there's some books that I'll start reading and I'm all gung-ho on them, and then there are other books that I have to read and want to read as well, so that initial book is sitting around for a long period of time.
Yeah, we all have our guilt piles, don't we?
I mean,
you know, the magazines pile up, you get that stack of New Yorkers in the corner glaring at you, and then you've got the books you bought glaring at you.
Right, and we have to say goodbye. I got so carried away, we're out of time. Thanks, Dwight. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and to John Treader for producing this hour.